codes kill kittens and customer service is an oxymoron. One podcast has set out to make things right. This is the Unpodcast with your hosts, Scott Stratton and Allison Kramer.
Week two in the pain train. Scott's still in pain because we recorded the same time as last week's.
And as we learned, Bush League, not a real expression.
But, well, hang on. I'll make Wayne go back in the tape.
I'm just kidding.
And tell us that it's a real thing.
But over the last week, we've received so many emails.
We haven't. It was 20 minutes ago.
I don't know what you're talking about. It came out last week. This is real time podcasting, and I was right, and you were wrong.
This is the first show, by the way. I'm drinking coffee with no sugar.
Why? Why would you do that to yourself?
Just seeing how it going. Just want to see how it goes.
How it going?
Yeah, that's how it's going. By the way, I can't even speak right. It's so terrible. So. Yeah. Anyway, so on the show today, a bunch of crap. But I want to start it with American Airlines story. Personal double story.
Okay, a personal double story.
Good and the bad.
All right, I'm ready. Which one are you going to do first?
You tell me.
The good.
All right. So over the weekend, I had a gig in Dallas, Texas, for those that don't know. And I went down and as a few of you know, my brother lives down there, Christopher, and who doesn't exist on the internet. And so he runs kind of party band companies, wedding bands, and things like that. So he said, I'm coming down. He's like, bring that fancy, shiny suit of yours because I got a custom-made suit from Quattro Menswear in Yorkville in Toronto. I went to school with my man Joe back in college, and he runs a custom tailor in Yorkville. So I think I'm fancy pants. I need literal fancy pants. So I got it done, went for a couple fittings. We wore it to a gala in Oakville. And if I do say so myself, it's fantastic. And so Chris said, bring that fancy suit of yours because we're going to go to some of the events that his bands are playing at. And they're all weddings and stuff and a gala. And we need to look the part. So I brought the suit with me. This is the first time I've ever traveled with a suit.
Okay.
So understanding that, you walk in. This is the first time I also got to use the business class closet to hang the suit in as I got on. There's a special closet reserved for us.
That's why you really got the suit.
So you could hang it
in the closet. Yeah.
So getting on the plane, put the suit and my suit bag onto the thing, and we got to Dallas, and I put it on, and I looked phenomenal. And then, anyways, did that. It was great, great night. Next day, did the gig. Awesome. And then came back. So got on the plane again with my suit bag and my carry-on bag, and I looked at the flight attendant. I'm like, can I put this in the closet? He's like, of course. So I hung it in the closet. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to forget it. He's like, no, you won't. Got on the plane, did the flight. Awesome. Played my Nintendo Switch. Greatest purchase I've ever done for a flight, for a plane. Playing vids on my flight. Killer, playing Doom, playing Rayman, playing Zelda. We land. It's late. It's 10:30 Sunday night. All I want to go home is go home and see my wife. Right? And the kids. But, you know, I want to see
them. They're asleep.
Yeah. So I leave the plane. I'm walking towards customs because we land in Canada, and halfway to customs, I realize what?
I already know what you realize, but you realize, of course, that you forgot your suit in the fancy closet.
And this is my fancy suit.
In the fancy closet.
This is a really expensive fancy suit that took a month and a half to 2 months total time to get, and I freaking left it on the plane. And you, if you've ever been off a plane, you know you can't go back. Going to custom. This isn't like getting off at a domestic flight and going, you just walk into the gate area where everybody's already hanging out to get on the plane. You can't go back in this. There's all these do not enter, do not walk this way. I stop and I just freeze. And I'm like, oh no. I can't call somebody. There's no way at 10:30 at night I'm getting through to anybody. I don't even know who to call. So what do? I go to Twitter. And I check American Airlines Twitter account, and I see they were active a minute ago, responding to somebody. There's still somebody there on a Sunday night at 10:30. So I don't even publicly do it. I don't even try to leverage my fake following on Twitter. I sent them a DM, because I've DM'd them in the past, and I said, hey, I just got off this flight. Here's my flight number. Here's all the things. I left my suit in the front closet. I can't go back. I'm stuck right now standing here. A minute later, okay, do you know what? you know what the suit looks like? I'm like, it's the only suit bag hanging in there.
And it has his name sewn on the inside of it. So when he opens his jacket, his name's embroidered inside.
In the suit. It'll be easy to tell.
Like kids' lunches. You always write your name in your suit.
They write back, and three, four minutes later, they write back. The gate attendant has got it, and we'll meet you at baggage claim. I'm like, what? Like, 4 minutes later. So I go through customs, and I walk to the baggage area. I don't see an attendant standing with my suit. I'm like, oh, well, how am I going to? And then, if you left a suit on American Airlines flight from Dallas, come to the desk, which is 6 feet away. I turn and I'm like, that's me, before they finish the announcement. And four people went, oh, you're the suit guy. And whoop, handed it over. And then one of the guys who works for the grounds crew looks at me and goes, next time, leave an iPad.
Can't take your custom suit and wear it.
And I got my suit.
Nice.
I got it back.
It's a good story.
Grand total of an extra 6 minutes, I got my suit back from them. I've been flying American a lot more recently, just because of routes, really. There's not really, I'm trying to try a new airline or like a new pizza place or something, but it's been really good. And so now the flip side of that, we're sitting in business class. There's four rows, I think, in it, and I'm in the third row. And I look up in the first row, and sometimes the problem with the first row is you don't have anywhere to put your feet. There's no seat in front of you. You can put your feet underneath, right? So you're up against the bulkhead, as they say, the wall. And I look up, and sure enough, I had yet to witness this until this day, that somebody took their shoes off. And this is a person who is like, you know, those dock shoes where they wear shoes with no socks.
Yeah.
And since they took their shoes off, they just put their bare feet up on the wall.
Ew, gross.
For all to see.
That is both gross for other people on the plane and for their particular feet, because I don't think that's the cleanest space in the world to put your foot on.
I have never got more all caps reaction to a post
gross.
Than when I posted that.
The photo of it?
Yeah. I took a shot. Didn't show his face.
Do you think that, like, is that within the range of something that, like, a flight attendant should ask the person to put their foot down?
100%. Now, like, that is just... Now, mind you, I have taken off my shoes before, my boots before, sometimes on a long flight.
With your socks on.
Yes. So I'm half a problem. Bare feet.
I take my shoes off.
Bare feet's over the line for me.
But I have socks on.
But we've now, and friends of ours have shown us two pictures of somebody's bare foot coming between the seats, through the seats.
I definitely wouldn't put my bare foot on that wall. And I wouldn't put my bare foot on any surface. Like, I'm hesitant to put my hands on the surfaces on the airplane, let alone to put my foot up on it. That would be gross. But I wouldn't take my socks off.
And then
that's too far for me.
Somebody shared with us on Twitter yesterday, because of the post I made with the foot on the wall, some guy's like, check this one out. And the guy beside the person, an older gentleman, had bare feet. And he kind of crossed his leg over, so his foot was in the other seat person's area, touching their tray.
Ew, that's too much.
Touching the tray beside them.
That's disgusting. I kind of feel for flight attendants in that situation, because I think it would be hard to go up to somebody. Obviously, the person is in their own universe and doesn't think about other people, probably doesn't know other people exist. Because you have to be pretty callous to take your sock off and put your foot up on the wall of an airplane. So yeah. I can't imagine that person would have reacted well if the flight attendant had come over.
Especially
so I feel
class.
For flight attendants anyway. But yeah, that's making it uncomfortable for other customers. And it's disgusting.
And on the brighter side, on the flight down, there was probably about a two-year-old or so, was all some business class.
Your reaction was so cute.
And he was just very energetic. And
this is Scott, like, to a T. So he sends me a message. Somebody brought their child on business class, so I got to play cars, happy face. That was your message to me.
And the kid was rolling the car down the aisle, and it was two rows in front of me.
I got to play cars.
And I got to catch the car and roll it back. Must have been like 40 times. I don't get to play with cars a lot.
So. No, we're kind of past the car.
Yeah.
We're like buying cars for kids. We're not.
And a couple of us were
playing cars. Anymore.
A couple of us were kind of playing with the kid, and one guy was kind of having none of it.
Yeah.
So when the car would kind of hit his foot, he would begrudgingly take it until the rest of us started playing with it, and then he was okay with smiling. I'm like, don't be grumpy. This kid's two. Like,
yeah, you don't
were
have
also
to engage,
two
but
once.
You don't
yeah.
have to be grumpy.
Yeah. So that was so all around interesting and exciting flights down.
I have a story for you.
All right.
So this made me laugh. It says, it's a retail article. It's from Business Insider. It says, millennials are dressing more like their parents, and it's terrible news for H&M and Forever 21. And there's a picture in the article that is a giant butt wearing Levi's jeans, which is, I guess, how parents dress. That's what it's supposed to represent. So it says millennials are ditching fast fashion retailers and flocking to thrift stores. The resale market in the U.S., so clothing resale market, used clothing, has outperformed the overall retail market in the past 5 years and is now worth $20 billion, according to research firm IBIS World. Brands are responding by bringing back archive collections and embracing vintage styles. So it says secondhand shopping is booming, and it shows that customers are growing tired of fast fashion retail. In the past 5 years, the $20 billion resale market in the U.S. has outperformed the overall retail market, according to research from IBIS World. The trend for secondhand shopping gained momentum in the post-recession period, when shoppers were looking to be more frugal with their spending. But its popularity today isn't only motivated by a desire to be more cost-conscious. Millennials are becoming increasingly aware of the negative environmental impact of cheap fashion, and they're growing tired of low-quality throwaway styles being churned out by certain retailers. So there's a few things I have to say about this, but I think what is interesting about this is that I like the general idea of people not being into fast fashion. Like, I think that there is a problem with the world when, you know, we buy things and we just assume we're going to throw them away, right? I mean, and that's a general problem. It's not only clothes, but appliances and a million other things that we have in our lives, furniture that we think like, well, we'll just get new ones, because once it gets thrown out, it goes somewhere. It doesn't vanish like smoke, you know, especially if we're not donating it or recycling it or reusing it. It becomes garbage, and garbage is obviously wasteful. Also, a lot of electricity and energy and resources go into making the clothes in the first place. And if we're just constantly churning out new stuff, all that resource and energy gets used up and then it's gone. I don't have it to use again. So I like that. I like this idea. I don't think it has anything to do with them being millennials personally. I don't think that buying secondhand clothes is something new. I remember being young and buying a lot of secondhand clothes, and I do think cost is certainly an issue. I think there's also the idea that you can get better clothes that are used than you can afford with the same amount of money in new clothes, especially when new clothes are cheap and falling apart. And the H&M Forever 21 that they mention are definitely at the bottom of the barrel in terms of like quality of clothes. So things that are going to get rips easily, not on purpose rips, but, you know, yeah, accidental rips, and things, they're going to be harder to launder and they're going to fall apart. And so, you know, the same, let's say $50 in a used clothing can buy you better quality clothes. And I remember buying used clothes when I was a kid, and it certainly isn't new. I don't think stores bringing out vintage clothing that they released, you know, many seasons ago solves that problem, because it's just old clothes that's been in their warehouses, right, or they're remanufacturing with the same level of quality. This kind of older style clothes, which I say in with air quotes, you know, and putting it back out thinking it's the style of the used clothes. I don't think it is the style. I think also what we're seeing is the technology making it more possible to get used clothes.
Yes.
Right? Like now, if I want to find some, like, particularly vintage stuff, but not only vintage, if I want to buy a used purse of a certain brand that I really like, or used jeans of a certain brand I really like, now in my phone, I can find sellers all over the world, and places like, you know, Facebook has Marketplace and all these different marketplaces. But not only that, just common searches on Google can come up with tons of ways to buy the clothes you're looking for. So I think it's also access. I think millennials have, of that age group, have more access to finding used clothing of good quality in certain brands that they're interested in having. And it's not always cheap brands. Like, and that's the difference that I see, where I don't think it has to, I think it's more expensive brands, but they're, and better quality clothing, but now they have this technology that gives you access to being able to find them. And I think that's something that maybe when we were kids, if you wanted like used jeans, you had to go to the used clothing stores. A lot of them, I remember going to Toronto on used clothing shopping trips, so I could go to thrift stores and buy clothes.
At Kensington Market.
Yeah, so, and that was really cool. And then my mom hated it because she was my mom, and, you know, you had to wash them up because she thought it was disgusting to wear someone else's clothes. And I think partially that's just being young and wanting to do that. I think partially it's a money situation, but I think also it's access. Like anything else that we look at in business, technology has given us access to so much breadth, right, in our searches.
I think also technology is only at its infancy when it comes to the used clothing market. Imagine if now, I understand the target market for Salvation Army stores and Goodwill stores and what's the other one that's here? any used clothing stores. A lot of the marketplace might be people just looking for bargains. But it, when you call them vintage, which is the same thing as old, just more expensive when you call them vintage, if you had an inventory system, if Goodwill or Salvation Army had an online inventory system, I know there's a cost involved in this. I know there's a lot, but we're looking at holes and gaps and where a disruption can happen. Imagine you could say, I'm a size 32 and I want a worn looking type of jeans and stuff. Well, here, this location has seven of them right now.
And stuff. But I think it's not as complicated as you think. Every article of clothing that is sold in the United States or in Canada has to have a UPC code on it. Like they come inventoried.
Right.
And that code only needs to be put on the label that's sewn inside the shirt for it to be traveled. Like now it tends to be on the packaging.
Yeah.
But if it was sewn inside the shirt, that would travel that piece of clothing throughout its life. Right. And I think there's a difference in the market you're talking about, where you're talking about clothes that weren't that expensive to begin with. Like if you're talking about going to like Salvation Army and looking for old jeans and stuff, which you can get some really cool stuff, that's different than saying like you want to get jeans that were $300, $400. You want to buy them for $100 because they're a couple years old. That's totally out of that price range. Just because it's used doesn't mean that it's a bargain hunt. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
It can also be either a quality hunt or a brand hunt. Like, I want to own this brand of jeans. Purses is a huge thing. There's a huge secondhand market of purses. And you can go, I looked once at selling a purse, and you can go online, there's sites all over, and put a photo of the purse and the code and the year, because they have little markings on them that show that it's authentic, especially if you have the certificate of authenticity from when you bought it. And you can, like, thousands of dollars. And then, of course, it hits the other side of the arc where they're worth even more because they're old. That's when you're in the vintage kind of side of things, right? But that's what I think that they're missing the point a little bit in the article when they're talking about, like, you know, that they want to dress like their parents or something. I don't think it's that at all. I just think it's a access, which is huge.
Value Village. That's what I was trying to think of.
Value Village, yeah.
I was watching something on YouTube when I was in Dallas in a hotel room, because that's my life on the road, watching YouTube videos. And I watched the channel Complex, and it's about shoes and stuff. And, so these sneakerheads are always... So
yeah, that's a great example, right?
They had Birdman was on this one, which is a new documentary about his life. The legendary hip-hop artist from the States, and he was going to shoe shop with this guy. And he talked about his Air Force Ones and stuff that he wears. And he said, the guy loves white Air Force Ones. And he's like, so how do you keep them so clean all the time? What's your big thing? And he's like, I wear them once.
Yeah.
That was it. He wears them once.
But then people collect them, right?
And then he throws them away or donates them.
Yeah.
I'm like, Birdman.
No, but people will pay tons of money for those. Yeah. And especially once something's discontinued. And sneakers are a great example, right? Once it's discontinued, it becomes even more valuable oh my gosh, you have that rare shoe, or they all get... chronicled and bookmarked, and then people want those particular years of the shoe.
Yeah.
So, I think it's interesting. And I think you're right. It's just at the tip of the iceberg of what technology is going to do for used clothing. And I personally think it's great. We wrote about in Unbranding, there's a whole chapter about Patagonia and their kind of fundamental core belief of, really servicing the clothing, and that this is a lifelong purchase, and taking the clothes back and repairing them and all this kind of stuff. And that it shouldn't, it's more than just one piece of clothing and you throw it away. Like other people should be using it, or you could repair it, or it could get passed along to somebody. And I think it's important.
Do you think that would have helped L.L. Bean when they came, remember they came out and said, we are no longer offering a lifetime guarantee? Was that L.L. Bean we were talking about? What story? Yeah. They were the ones that rescinded it a month or two ago. You think if they came out with a Patagonia style of warranty, which was repair?
Maybe repair versus return? Or even something like what we saw Indy do, where if you can't repair it, you can't resell it, you can't fix it for somebody, then at least donate it.
Right.
At least partner with a company that says, like, okay, so you spend a couple $100
like
on something.
Indy too, yeah.
Yeah. And you can't. For whatever reason, you can't use it anymore. Here are partners. They'll come pick up your clothing. They'll come and then do whatever you want with it. Either they can donate it and actually give it to people, or turn it into mattresses or whatever you do with used clothing down the line. But at least it gets reused and it's made into something.
Right. Yeah, perfect. All right. Our fine province of Ontario, where we live in Canada, came out and said, as this past March 1st, we're banning door-to-door sales on certain things.
That was my birthday.
Yay. So two great things happened on that date. My wife celebrates her birth. And no more door-to-door sales. So this is from actually from the Ontario's website. Starting March 1st, which is this past March 1st, Ontario bans unsolicited door-to-door sales of certain household appliances to better protect consumers from aggressive and misleading contracting at home. Businesses will only be able to enter into a contract in the consumer's home if the consumer has contacted the business ahead of time and invited them into their home for the purpose of entering into a contract. Contracts that are in violation of the new rules relating to door-to-door contracts solicitations will be considered void, and consumers will be able to keep the goods and services with no obligation. The new rules will apply to air cleaners, air conditioners, air purifiers, duct cleaning services, furnaces, water filters, water heaters, water purifiers, water softeners, water treatment devices, and bundles of these goods or services. A lot of air and water.
That's the only people I've ever seen, like, their services come to the door here a lot.
Hydro, too,
the only
right?
people that I've ever come to the door selling anything were a water filtration company.
Right. Yes. In addition, businesses will be required to keep a record of how contact with the consumer entering the contract was made, and all contracts signed in the home of these goods and services will also have a 10-day cooling off period, allowing consumers to cancel the contract for any reason without penalty.
That's smart.
Protecting consumers is part of Ontario's plan. Blah, 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 blah. The plan includes higher minimum wage. Anyway, door-to-door contracts have been among the top complaints received by the Ministry of Government and Consumer Services. Ontario is the second province in Canada to restrict door-to-door solicitations and contracts. And businesses will need to keep a record of how the contract was signed. So
that's smart, I think.
I love it.
Yeah, that will. I think it will help protect people.
Now you just have to get the awareness out that this exists.
Yeah.
And then that's also the part of the, maybe sometimes the bigger part of the challenge as well.
So I found the next documentary that we need to go see. It's not out yet, but which is kind of sad. But this is from the WashingtonPost.com. It says, The Flaming Hot Cheetos Movie, How a Frito-Lay Janitor Created One of America's Most Popular Snacks. Flamin' Hot Cheetos, the spicy red version of the classic cheese-flavored snack, are something of a cultural phenomenon. A group of children rapping about them racked up more than 16 million views on YouTube. Pop star Katy Perry even dressed as a Flamin' Hot for Halloween. Although several schools banned them, saying they were unhealthy, the snacks enjoy the kind of high profile that research chefs and food scientists employed by big companies like Frito-Lay spend their careers chasing. But Flamin' Hot Cheetos weren't made by any experts. They were invented by a janitor, the son of a Mexican immigrant who dropped out of school because he struggled with English. His name is Richard Montañez. The Fox Searchlight Pictures is making a movie about his life. Lewis Kulick, who wrote Charlie St. Cloud and October Sky, will pen the first draft of the screenplay based on the initial pitch from Montañez and producer Devon Franklin, Variety reported. The biopic, titled Flamin' Hot, will follow my... Oh, what are we going to name your life story?
Oh, out the window.
Will follow Montañez's real-life rags-to-riches tale. He grew up on a farm... migrant labor camp in California, a tiny town centered on winemaking. As a child, one of 11 siblings, he picked grapes at the vineyards and ate at a communal table with several other families. But he had an entrepreneurial streak even then. In his memoir, A Boy, A Burrito, and a Cookie, he described arriving at his white elementary school during segregation. His bus was green, while the white children rode a yellow bus. Speaking only Spanish, he couldn't understand anyone. He felt like an outsider, especially at lunchtime, when he pulled out a burrito. In the 1960s, Mexican food wasn't the popular staple in white communities as it is now. The other kids, with their bologna sandwiches and cupcakes, stared on in confusion until he grew embarrassed and put it back in his bag. He begged his mom to make him the same food as everyone else, but she refused. Instead, the next day, she made him two burritos for lunch and told him to make a friend. By the end of the week, he was selling burritos to his white classmates for 25 cents each. I learned at that moment that there was something special about being different, and there was a reason that we all couldn't fit into the same box. His background would prove useful later again, but first it presented an obstacle. Montañez's struggle to learn English was so severe he dropped out of school at a young age. He worked various low-paying jobs from slaughtering chickens to gardening around town, picking up English along the way. When he was about 12 years old, he landed a job working as a janitor in California's Frito-Lay plant. One day, as he told Lowrider magazine, he saw a company-wide video of the then CEO Roger Enrico saying, "We want every worker in this company to act like an owner, make a difference. You belong to the company, so make it better." And he said he took the words to heart. "Here's my invitation. Here's the CEO telling me, the janitor, that I can act like an owner," Montañez later recalled in the 2014 League of United Latin American Citizens National Convention. "I didn't know what I was going to do. Didn't need to, but I knew I was going to act like an owner." As he tells it, one day an assembly line plant where he worked broke down. A batch of Cheetos didn't receive the orange cheesy dust that make them so popular, so he took home a few to experiment. He had formed an idea while watching a street vendor in his neighborhood make elote, or grilled Mexican street corn, corn on the cob covered in cheese, butter, lime, and chili. What if I took the same concept and applied it to a Cheeto, he thought, according to his memoir. So we did. His friends and family loved the results. Thinking back to the video and figuring he had nothing to lose, he decided to call Enrico and pitch the idea. He took his call, told Montañez to present the product in 2 weeks, so the janitor went out and brought his first ever tie for $3, then stopped by the library to get a book on marketing and copied a strategy out of it to recite during the presentation. I'm a bit of an artist, so I even designed the bags to put the Cheetos on and put Cheetos on it, he told Fox News Latino. Against all odds, it worked. Enrico loved the idea, and a new line of spicy snack food was born, with Flamin' Hot Cheetos as its flagship. Montañez has since served in various positions throughout the company, including as an executive vice president. Many times, greatness will come in ridiculous forms. A ridiculous idea might be a billion-dollar idea, he told Fox News Latino. He now travels around the country giving speeches on the importance of diversity in business. His message is always simple, as he told the audience at the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce in 2013's Power of Diversity event. If you have confidence, you can walk into any room, he said. Your job is to prepare yourself to walk through the doors. It certainly worked for him, and while his wardrobe has grown considerably since he walked into the room with Enrico, he still holds on to the $3 tie.
That's great.
Isn't it great?
I love that
story. I want to talk to him now. He's my hero.
I got to put that in the next book.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to Flaming Hot Cheetos, man, and you definitely have already have two fans for the movie, so we're in.
Well done.
Isn't that a great story? But you know what I love, too? The fact that he was inspired by the owner. If the owner hadn't put out that video, like, a lot of the time we talk about, like, that sort of culture, or I don't know the lack of a better word, for a company being set by the people who are kind of leading the company. But, like, his leadership, his fact that he made that video and set that tone for people and sent that message to people gave him the kind of the door, right? Then he could have chosen not to go through it. He could have chosen not to say anything. And probably most people heard it and said, oh, that's nice, and then went about their business. But for some people, that's permission to give input or feedback or just to feel better in their job because someone told them they should act like their owners. I think it's such a great story from getting the opportunity and the fact that, you know, he's obviously been given credit for the idea, which is wonderful too. I think it's fantastic. I love everything about it.
I'm going to look up the revenue here, see if we've got it. It's amazing to when you realize that everybody has ideas and everybody has worth and value, right? It's amazing to me.
And imagine, like, he started there at 12 years old in 1976. He got the job as a janitor in the plant.
Amazing, right? Okay, I don't see it. Everybody's just talking about the movie, so that's cool. Although his,
let's see if there's any. I love that it's called Flaming Hot. Let's buy his biography.
Yeah.
A boy, a burrito, and a cookie. And good for his mom. What a great mom.
Right?
Right? Like, to empower him and show him that, just say that he shouldn't change who he is just because of what other people think, and send him with two burritos and tell him to make a friend. I love that story.
Just make a friend. I love it. All right.
I'm going to buy his documentary. I mean, his autobiography. So, awesome. Good story.
Send us a tweet or a message or something too, and we'll pick a listener that we'll send a copy of the book to as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And you can also join us. This is from thedailybeast.com. It's talking about the social app Vero.
The pain in your voice.
It sums it up perfectly here. So it just says, every few years, a new viral social platform emerges to supposedly rescue us from the clutches of Facebook. A
few months, I would say.
In 2014, we had Elo. 2015, it was Peach. 2018, it's Vero, a buggy Instagram clone that promises to bring back meaningful connections. Vero skyrocketed to the top of the App Store this week, claiming the number one spot in the social media category and surpassing 1 million downloads. But already some users are calling for deletion due to problematic past of its founder and CEO, Ayman Hariri. He's a billionaire Lebanese businessman and son of an assassinated former Lebanese prime minister, Rafik Hariri. He told CNBC in March 2017 he founded Vero because he was frustrated with other social networks. Quote, when I did join existing social networks, I found the options for privacy were quite limited and difficult to understand, and was also when I decided to get on and connect with a few of my friends. I noticed that their behavior online was very different than their behavior in the real world. They hired a team of Russian developers to build the social app and has since been on a media tour promoting it as the next Facebook.
No one believes in privacy like Russian developers.
Mm-hmm. The app actually launched back in 2015, billing itself as a relationship-first social network. Though it looks almost exactly like Instagram, but with a darker, more cluttered color scheme, the platform does not have some notable differences that have fueled its recent growth. Photographers like it because it doesn't make you crop your photos into any set dimensions. Influencers like it because it offers a chronological timeline free of algorithms.
For now.
And other people like it because you have the option to designate who's a close friend, who's an acquaintance, and who's just a follower. You can set the audience for each post.
Can
also,
you
there's
do that
no
on
ads.
Facebook?
Instead, users pay a subscription fee to use the app. Yeah. So, before I get into the shady past of this guy, all those descriptions of what makes it different was exactly what Instagram was, what Facebook was, what Twitter was. Before you have to monetize, you know, you can be free with a lot of things.
Or you care. You don't care about. It being chronological when you only have like maybe under 100 people that you follow or who follow you. But once you have a big amount of people that you're following, all of a sudden the chronological style is so mind-numbing and you don't actually get to see the things that are important to you. And that's where the algorithm comes in and the functionality of it improves with seeing things you actually want to see based on what you've been looking at, right?
Yeah.
Chronological is great when you have a small following.
Yeah, and just these and all the shady things where the hashtag delete Vero came out was things like before beginning his social media escapades, Hariri served as a deputy chief executive officer and vice chairman of his family's now defunct construction company. Throughout this time, the company was plagued with problems and allegations of abuse. Under his watch, over 31,000 complaints of non-payment of wages were filed.
Cheap.
The company also was so negligent that some in the Saudi Arabian government had to step in and provide food and basic living supplies to workers.
Oh my goodness.
Unpaid workers were forced to live in crowded dorms and labor camps constructed by the companies. 2016, throughout their time working for them, many workers were denied access to food, water, and medical care. So far, there have been no allegations of abuse or unpaid wages made against Vero. However, many in the tech community have spoken out against Hariri himself, imploring users not to download his app, with many voices citing his past infractions. Just so everyone knows, people behind this app are just about as awful as the app itself. Another one was, don't download this thing unless you're using a burner phone. said Palo Alto-based artist Mr. Fing, who previously founded his own social network called Fing.com. Fing said also it made him uncomfortable how vague the company is about what it plans to do with user data. And he, like many on Twitter, was frustrated when he discovered he couldn't simply delete his account after signing up.
Oh, gosh.
You have to put in a request.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
Not good.
De Silva also told the Daily Beast that the foreign development team was a huge red flag. Though plenty of startups outsource development, many don't have CEOs whose brothers are close with Vladimir Putin. Woo!
All right. You didn't even need any of those reasons not to think it was a good idea.
I haven't joined a new social network.
No, it's been a long time.
The problem is what happens here is the people in our circles to jump and join it for it's the digital land rush.
Yeah, they just want to be the first.
You want to get your name there. You want to be on there. It happened with Google Plus. Remember, I got just ripped by a few of my friends privately about... Yeah. That I should be embracing Google
Not
Plus.
Not with Google,
the
I
next
mean,
thing.
Like, if like, anyone was going to be able to do it, it was kind of Google. Like,
and I just know.
They knew a couple of things.
It wasn't different enough, and it wasn't relevant enough to do. It was the same, like you said about, we were talking in the last episode. It was the same stuff being posted that was being posted everywhere else. And if your big thing is chronological and no ads, well, that's how everything else was too.
Yeah.
Until they got to a certain peak momentum with it, and then had to start paying investors back somehow. So I don't buy the hype. I'm just tired. I'm just tired of all of it.
Would you like a made-up word?
Yep.
All right. Made-up word. Don't make any sense. Made-up word. Don't mean no offense. Made-up word. It brings laziness. What is all this craziness? Says it's from Mazen Sidahmed, and he's a reporter and associate editor at the Guardian Mobile Innovation Lab. And it says, introducing a new format for evolving stories. Smarticles aim to meet readers where they last left off. Smarticles.
Smart articles.
Oh, would imagine. I'm going to read a little bit of this. It says, yeah. With the relentlessness of the news cycle over the past few years, nobody can blame readers for feeling overwhelmed. It's become almost impossible to stay up to date on the latest developments in the most recent ongoing news stories. You know what really bothers me? I read this a lot. So much news. It's become impossible. Has it? Really? Has it become impossible?
No.
If you spend a half an hour every single morning of your life reading a reputable news source, you can stay on top of news stories. It hasn't become impossible. Why do people keep telling me it's impossible?
Because they're selling you something to help it.
But what if there was a smarter way of getting the latest news on an ongoing, incremental, developing topic? The Guardian Mobile Innovation Lab is experimenting with a new story format that claims to provide readers an easier way to follow ongoing, developing stories on mobile devices. The story format, named Smarticles, because it's smarter than an article, breaks stories up into their core elements. So it's an outline.
And then, here's the thing, though. You go back, and it then looks at the algorithm and says, what else do you need to see in the article that's important?
Why don't you just read the article, people? Read reputable articles. You don't need new news every 8 seconds. You just, once a day, read the news. Maybe twice, in the morning and at night. And then, unless it's like a breaking news story, just let it go in between and wait for people to read all the information and intelligent, educated people to sort through it for you. And then just read the updates.
We can thank Dean Shaw for sending that one and getting Allison angry.
So angry, Dean.
It sounded like me. I like it. I like it. She's fed up.
It's not hard.
Do what, sound like me or get fed up?
Both.
On that note, she's Scott, I'm Scott. Next week. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and visit theunpodcast.com. And remember, friends don't let friends use QR codes.